This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new TV season is in full swing. Over the next half hour, we'll feature interviews from our archives with some of the people involved with two of the season's new shows. The new series, Frasier, is a spin-off from Cheers. Now Frasier hosts a radio call-in psychology show. But he's having psychological adjustment problems of his own because his father's just moved in with him. The father is played by John Mahoney. Mahoney got his start in theater. He was invited to join the Steppenwolf Theater Company in Chicago by the company's co-founder, John Malkovich. He's since appeared in such films as Eight Men Out, Say Anything, Moonstruck, In the Line of Fire, and Striking Distance. I spoke with him in May of 1990, before his performance of David Mamet's adaptation of Chekhov's Uncle Vanya. Acting as Mahoney's second career, he used to edit a medical journal. I asked him what he covered.
Ophthalmology or cataract surgery or central supply, or it could be anything, virtually any aspect of the healthcare system as it is within a hospital. And it's very, very boring, actually. I've tried to think of some way to make it more interesting, but it isn't, and it wasn't, which is a lot to do with why I don't do it anymore.
When did you know that you were really unhappy in this job?
Well, it wasn't anything that where you go home every night and bang your head against a wall and say, "Oh my God, I'm so unhappy." It was just an insidious thing. You just keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and gradually you realize that you're smoking an awful lot, and that you're drinking a little bit too much, and that you're sleeping very late whenever you can. And it wasn't until I started to do my new job, which was acting, that I looked back and realized the absolute depth of my depression while I was doing the editorial work.
All the years that you weren't acting and you were mm-hmm. editing this medical newsletter, did mm-hmm. you use any acting skills in your life?
No, I didn't. I think I was storing up a lot of things that I have used since.
You weren't sitting at your desk impersonating people or just using in everyday life skills associated with acting.
No, I really wasn't, unless lying is part of that, you know. I mean, obviously I'd have to lie to writers who couldn't write their way out of a paper bag and tell them how wonderful they were as I tried to make their stuff publishable. So maybe if good acting is good lying, then maybe I was doing that.
You grew up in England. What mm-hmm. happened to your English accent?
Well, I tried very hard to lose it. I immigrated to the States when I was 19, and I'm from the north of England. I'm not the sort of person who likes to stand out in a crowd, which might sound strange for an actor. I mean, I like to shine on the stage or in a film, but on one-on-one, I just like to be like everybody else. And even in those days, it used to drive me crazy when people would say, "Oh, I love the way you talk. Oh, isn't that wonderful?" Or say this, or say that, or say banana, or say, you know. And they were being nice, but it would drive me crazy. And so I set out to learn how to speak like an American. And I would ask people, I was in the Army at the time, and I'd ask people, "How do you pronounce this? How do you say half?" And they'd say half. And I'd say, "How do you say banana? How banana?" And I'd write them down, and I'd drill myself just like I was learning a foreign language. The only trouble was I was in the Army with people from all over the United States, so somebody from Nebraska would tell me how to say one thing, and somebody from Brooklyn would tell me how to say something else. So I had this horrible mongrel accent when I got out. But when I went to school in Quincy, Illinois, I went to Quincy College, and by the time I got out of Quincy, of course, it had pretty much settled into this Midwestern thing that I have now. But I tried very hard to lose it, and it was to fit in. As boring as that sounds, it was to be like everybody else. That's why I did it.
You know how you worked on your voice to get rid of your English accent?
Uh-huh.
When you started acting, did you do any work with your voice on enunciation? You have a beautiful voice and great enunciation.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, not over-enunciation, but
yeah.
It's just really great. Did you work that up? Was it natural already?
That was pretty natural, yes. I'll tell you, I worked on the timbre of my voice when I was doing Orphans before we moved to New York.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to be playing an alcoholic, and I wanted a rough quality in my voice that I didn't have. And so I worked very, very hard to get a gravelly quality to it. And my voice never quite recovered from that. And so it sounds a little different now than it did when I first started out. But it's to my advantage, actually, because I guess I have a much more distinctive voice now than I used to have. And people notice it and remember me by it, which I like very much. As far as enunciation, no. That just comes, I think, from possibly being born and raised in England, perhaps, or I just do tend to enunciate. I remember John Malkovich telling me, you know, you're the only person I know who speaks in sentences. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, when you say lines, you can see where the period comes. You can see where the capital letter starts. You can see where the paragraph ends. And I noticed when I watched other people in Steppenwolf work, that it's true. They try very consciously to break things up to make it more conversational. But you see, conversational to me is sentences. I think I express myself well, and I don't know whether it's my education or my background or because my family did. I never did speak that broken way. So
it must be hard for you to do Mammoth, then, huh?
Should I try? Well, no, actually, David at least writes in sentences.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to think of what would be more difficult. When we did In a Nightingale Sang, it was a little difficult because, or to do something like Virginia Woolf would be a little difficult because mm-hmm. it's written with so many ellipses. But Mammoth, no. Even though there are a lot of short one-word sentences even, it's at least you know what he wants. Even like in this particular adaptation of Uncle Vanya, at one point I say, eat, sleep, drink. I'm talking about the way my life is now as opposed to working. All I seem to do now is eat, sleep, drink. They're all one-word sentences, according to David, I guess to stop you from doing that horrible thing that so many people do now. All I do is eat and sleep and drink, you know, that horrible way that people have learned how to talk from television. And I guess as a way to get around that, David very specifically made them sentences, and so it stops you from doing that, and it's great. I love it because I wouldn't do it anyway, and it's nice to know that I'm doing what David wants as well.
When you were working up the gravelly voice, what did you do?
I used to lock myself in closets, and I used to do very, very strenuous vocal warm-up exercises, and people didn't want to be in the same room as me. I made these horrible sounds. I mean, I started slowly, and I warmed my voice up before I started doing that, and as far as I know, knock on wood, I haven't hurt it or damaged it, but people do say, especially as at the end of an evening when my voice is pretty much shot, or not at the end of an evening, but at the end of a two-show day, people get worried about it and say, you all right? Is your voice okay? And I say, oh, yeah, it's fine, no problem. It'll be back tomorrow just the same as, and it always is. It's always there just as strong as can be. But people the things that I did sound terrible. I know it shocked a lot of actors with the ferocity of my vocal warm-ups. It shocked a lot of people in New York.
What were you doing?
Well, I can't do it on the radio because, for one thing, it's much too loud. And for another thing, it's just much too ugly. You know, if I back way away from the microphone, I might be able to give you a little demonstration here. It's just something like,
Wow.
No, I don't know what you heard there because I backed away quite a bit.
That's really something, so you'd lock yourself up in a closet and do that for a long time.
Well, it's not, I mean, and I wouldn't do it just right off the bat, just like I did then.
Uh-huh.
I'd do very gentle things first, you know, just sort of, things like that until, for a good half hour, I spend a lot of time warming my voice up so that I don't damage it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm very happy with the way it turned out, actually. I think it's gotten me a lot of work, to tell you the truth.
John Mahoney plays Frasier's father in the new series Frasier. Dennis Franz and Stephen Botchko from our archives. After this break, this is Fresh Air. The new series NYPD Blue has brought together two fine actors and paired them as partners. David Caruso plays a cop who's willing to bend the law to get justice. Dennis Franz plays his partner, an older, even more cynical, burned-out cop. In this scene from the first episode, Caruso tries to straighten out Franz.
This has got to stop, Andy.
What's got to stop?
This. You're getting stiff every afternoon now.
Hey, look. I don't recall requesting any career counseling session from you.
When was the last time you tried going on a wagon?
When was the last time you tried growing tits?
All right, maybe we better talk in the morning.
No. Let's talk now.
Okay. I think we should call it quits.
Meaning what?
Meaning us being partners.
Yeah, sure. Get a little bored at home, you dump your wife. Got a few problems at work, you dump your partner.
First of all, I didn't dump her, she dumped me. And second of all, I've been carrying you. I know it, you know it. Every cop in the station house knows it. And I'm sick of it.
All right, you want to split up? That's no problem. It's no problem at all.
NYPD Blue is reminiscent of Hill Street Blues for a couple of obvious reasons. Both shows were co-created by Stephen Bochco. They both co-starred Dennis Franz. We've gone into the archives for interviews with each of them. Bochco also co-created L.A. Law and Doogie Howser. NBC approached him in the 70s to create a cop drama. I asked him how he wanted Hill Street to be different from other cop shows.
We started out with this sort of checklist of things we didn't want to be. And a lot of what we wound up with on Hill Street was kind of, it was a little bit like form following function. We had a large group of characters that we had developed, and what we discovered pretty quickly as we wrote the pilot is that there's no way on a weekly basis that we were going to be able to dramatically honor the needs of what had quickly become a dozen regular characters, 10 or 11, whatever the exact number was. And so we developed a story flow that would span 2, 3, 4 episodes at a time, because it was the only way that you could involve your characters in complex stories without devoting a lot of screen time per episode to those characters. And so in that way, we began to develop what really didn't seem all that new to us. It was sort of a police soap opera, and we sort of kiddingly always referred to it as cop soap.
You have the reputation for being the kind of producer who'll put his job on the line if there's something you really want to fight about with the network or standards and practices. What's an example of something you put your job on the line for in Hill Street?
Oh, gosh, there were so many of them. Gosh, I remember one time we had an episode where some elderly woman was having an affair, and her husband came home and caught them, and he chased the guy through the house, and the guy was trying to get out the bathroom window, and he got his head lodged in between the side of the toilet and the bathtub where he was stuck. So they called the police, and Hill and Renko arrive on the scene, and they're puzzling as to how to free this guy. And of course, they finally free him with they shatter the toilet with a sledgehammer. But in the course of it, the husband, who by now has sort of reconciled with his wife, turns to his wife, and it really was like a background piece of dialogue, and said, "What really upsets me is that you took your teeth out for him." And they went nuts. They simply went berserk over that piece of dialogue, which was a background piece of dialogue. They never objected to it on the page. So what happened was that we shot the scene. We didn't have close-ups coverage of the various elements in the scene. So there it was. It was not excisable from the scene, and they said you had to take it out. So I guess that's about as angry as I ever got, because, you know, the deal that I always had with them was if you give me time, I think I can pretty much accommodate any of the notes you have that I can't sway you on. But when you give me a note like that after we've shot the film, I'm trapped. And then, of course, to fix it, you have to butcher the film. You know, one of the interesting things we discovered over the years is that you'd have all these terrible fights in a vacuum. Then finally, and you'd scream and you'd yell and you'd rattle your saber and you'd threaten to quit, and they'd back down, and You shoot the film, and it goes on the air. Nobody says boo. Mm-hmm. Nobody writes you a letter. And what you begin to realize, A, is that you've got a far more sophisticated audience watching what you do than networks are willing to admit. And B, the Republic doesn't fall. That audience comes to you Thursdays at 10 o'clock looking for a degree of sophistication and complexity and humor. And they're very happy with the product they get, by and large.
Stephen Bochco co-created Hill Street Blues and the new series NYPD Blue. Watching Dennis Franz on NYPD Blue is like seeing an old friend, because his role is so similar to his character of Bunce on Hill Street. Bunce was a tough-talking, gum-chewing cop who was always ready to bend the rules to get the job done, which constantly got him into trouble with the captain. Physically, Bunce was hard to miss, a stocky, balding man dressed in wide ties and polyester suits. In this scene from Hill Street, Bunce tried to cut a deal with D.A. Joyce Davenport.
Miss Davenport.
I'm short on time, Lieutenant.
This won't take long.
If you're leading up to some kind of deal, I've already told the D.A. my client's not interested.
Your client's a flea, Miss Davenport. He's a microscopic particle. It's the people who hired him we want.
I've told you, Lieutenant, we're not looking for any deals. I'm doing court.
This is a deal with a difference, please. Seeing Higby's definitely going to do some time, probably a lot. The only question is what kind of time he's going to do, considering his condition.
What condition?
You're familiar with the exact nature of Higby's wound.
Lieutenant.
The way it lightened him up, I mean. So now he's a little short in the crucial equipment department.
I'm listening.
If Higby's fellow inmates were to somehow find out how he ain't the man he used to be, how he ain't even a man at all, so to speak.
You're saying he'd be abused?
As in badly.
And unless Higby names his alleged employers, you'd see to it that somebody got the word out. That offer is astoundingly improper, Lieutenant. You try it and I'll hit you with a restraining order.
Just tell him what I told you, all right?
I'll, of course, relay to Mr. Higby anything that's relevant to his case.
That's all we can ask, Counselor.
In 1987, I asked Dennis Franz about the tacky polyester suits he wore on Hill Street.
The first time I came in for a costume fitting and I saw all these polyesters and these clashing colors, I thought, oh boy, this something's off here, because first they've thrown his name at me, Norman Bunce, which I wasn't too thrilled about to begin with, and then they've given me this weird clothes, and I thought, our concepts are getting real strange here. So I kind of realized that what they wanted was we were after a list of contradictions in character, and I've described Norman Bunce as sort of a human mutt, and that he does have a lot of different characteristics, and they don't all fit into the same person, but somehow it's interesting to watch that. And my reasoning in why he chooses his clothes, I think he really feels that he's dressing pretty sharp. He just has
bad taste
in clothes. As long as everything he's wearing has brown in it, regardless of the pattern or which direction those patterns are going in, that's fine. He looks pretty swell, you know, as far as he's concerned, because they're all brown and blue or green or whatever the color may be.
Were you able to base that character on anyone you knew? And I guess I'm wondering, too, if you grew up in a tough neighborhood in Chicago or a working-class neighborhood in Chicago where you were apt to meet people like him.
I grew up in a suburb out of Chicago. It was about 7 miles out of the city proper in Maywood. The area was, yes, very much of a working-class neighborhood. My father was a postal worker, and he worked in a factory, and my mother also worked at the post office. There was a heavy, tough element in our neighborhood. We had gangs. I wasn't a part of them, but a lot of my friends were members of gangs, and therefore I had an association with them. I kind of walked a fine line always because I kept those friends, and then when I got involved in theater, of course the gangs didn't want to have nothing to do with the theater, so I had both sides of the fence, and I was able to play both sides too, so I had different groups of friends that were complete opposites. And I guess I... I guess it was a matter of me always observing, getting to your initial question about did I draw on any of anybody in particular to form the character. It's been sort of an observational existence that I've always had, watching the other sides and being in touch with both of them, but knowing how they work. But I don't specifically have one person that I can identify with in forming the character of Norman Bunce.
Something very unprecedented happened on your career with Hill Street Blues. You first had a role as a bad cop called Sal Benedetto back in the 82-83 series. You were on a few episodes of that. The character commits suicide, and then they brought you back a few years later in the role of Norman Bunce.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to leave? Did you ask to be let out of the series, or did they kill you off even though
you
wanted to stay?
I did everything possible to stay on that show. In fact, really, the course of events was that they were in the process of creating a new show called Bay City Blues, and that was about a minor league baseball team. Stephen Bochco, Jeffrey Lewis, and some of the other people at Hill Street were putting this new show together. They asked me if I would be interested in being a regular on that show. I absolutely said yes. They went ahead and they made Benedetto as bad as they could, so it necessitated him having to take his life and be eliminated from the show. Once Bay City was not successful, we made 8 episodes and it was canceled. I made every possible overture to get back on Hill Street. I realized I'm very fortunate that I have been able to be a part of my favorite show on television, and I missed that opportunity. I missed being a part of it, and I without question wanted to be with them again. And I said, whatever hair I got left, you can dye blonde. I'll get rid of my mustache. I'll come back as Benedetto's gay brother seeking revenge. I'll do anything to get back on a show. That's how much I love everybody over there. So we weren't able to work that out. It took a couple of years for my character to be able to return in the form of Norman Bunce.
Dennis Franz, recorded in 1987. You can see him now on NYPD Blue. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.